welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 1st of June, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Yes, we are into June, we are halfway through the year, and it's the beginning of another week, and of course that means I have my co-host Max Musson with me today from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
Good afternoon to you. Yes, I'm very well indeed. I'm enjoying the good weather that we're having at the moment, the glorious sunshine. It's good to get out and about more, and hopefully as we move on through the summer, we'll all be able to get out and about a lot more than we have been able to in the last few months. And I think really I've got quite a good feeling about the summer, actually, as a result of all this good weather. It's it really cheers people up, I think.
Yeah, it certainly does. They've said it's the hottest spring, the sunniest spring that we've had since records began. And of course, that's helpful for getting rid of the virus as well. I mean, you could say that just the weather in itself is going to be helpful in that aspect. But of course, it's hard to avoid talking about the virus. And the main news last week was Dominic Cummings' press conference that he gave outside the Houses of Parliament. It was a very, very strange affair. You don't normally get to see one of the Prime Minister's advisers giving his own press conference. They sort of hide in the background. But because of this media furore over him supposedly going to going up north to see his family when nobody else could go out and see their family, and apparently he went back there twice, and he went back there on a jolly, and all these things that turned out to be lies, basically, he was forced into giving this press conference. And I thought he gave a very good account of himself, to be honest. He has a four-year-old child. His child is actually autistic. There was nobody that would look after the child if him and his wife had come down with the coronavirus, because what person is going to want to look after a child that you know has got coronavirus? Nobody, no childminder is going to want to do that. So I think he sensibly thought, well, the only people that would actually look after the child if both of us are incapacitated is my family, and it was his nieces that said that they would look after the child. Obviously, nieces are about 16, 17, so even if they did catch the coronavirus, they're not in the extremely at-risk bracket. He showed that he hadn't gone back there on a jolly, and it's come out since then that the person that actually said that he saw him go back there was just making that up. The person that said that they saw him in the woods, it was his own woods. It was on his own land. So, and you're allowed to go out and exercise anyway. And he basically showed that a lot of what the press had been saying about him was a pack of lies. But that didn't stop the media. They continued. They continued trying to raise a lynch mob against him. He actually had a lynch mob outside of his house. This is before he even went away. That was one of the reasons why he thought, this is no good, I can't go into quarantine here, because we've got people outside shouting that they want to kill us. I mean, how's a four-year-old child going to respond to that? And then they were saying, well, he should have been apologising. And I, what's he got to apologise for? He kept the rules. And if he was to apologise, he'd be saying, well, I'm very sorry for putting my child first instead of the government, or instead of how it looks to the newspapers. So I think he was quite right not to apologise. I thought it was great that the government refused to back down. But as I say, the media continued, even after this, on the Monday, on the Tuesday, on the Wednesday, the BBC were still saying he should step down. I'm basically blackmailing the government, trying to force the government into carrying out the BBC's own policies. And the reason why they hate him is because he's put a stop to a plan to delay Brexit that had gone into action. While he was ill, while Boris Johnson was ill, these Whitehall mandarins had done a deal with the EU that we were going to delay Brexit instead of leaving in December. And of course, as soon as he was back in London, he put a stop to it. And that infuriated the left-wing media, basically. So I think he's won. There are other points I can go into about this, but what did you make of the press conference, Max?
Yeah, I think my analysis of the press conference is fairly similar to your own. One of the things that struck me, though, was that the difficulty that the government have had in justifying what Dominic Cummings did, and the difficulty that Dominic Cummings had in justifying what he did, was in them pandering to the notion that there has to be equality and that everybody should have the same rights as and privileges as everybody else, which, as we all know, is absolute nonsense. Boris Johnson very often draws wartime parallels and references Winston Churchill in some of these parallels that he draws. And the very simple way of dispelling these attacks by the media on Dominic Cummings would have just been to point out that at the time when he went up north, I think Boris Johnson had gone down with coronavirus. There were a couple of other ministers that had gone down with coronavirus. Others were being tested and what have you. And so we were in danger of having a period during this crisis where there would actually be nobody from the very few people from the cabinet actually able to take over and make any decisions on behalf of the government. And what Boris Johnson should have pointed out is that throughout the Second World War, we had rationing, and yet Winston Churchill was supplied with a copious quantity of whiskey and big Havana cigars, which aren't actually part of the, or which weren't part of the ration that everybody in Britain was supposed to have. Yet nobody complained about Winston Churchill having his whiskey and cigars, because Winston Churchill was a special person doing a special job. He was the Prime Minister and he was leading the country during a time of war. And all Boris Johnson needed to point out with regard to Dominic Cummings is that Dominic Cummings was a special person doing a special job. He was the only person in the world who was the chief advisor to the Prime Minister at the time, and so therefore in view of the Prime Minister's incapacity as a result of going down with coronavirus, it was essential that Dominic Cummings got his family to safety and came back to London as quickly as he could after he had recovered himself, so that there could be somebody in place who could actually make decisions. Simple as that.
Well, this was part of it, wasn't it? He was told he had to come back to London. He had to come back to work. So he went and tested his eyesight. And, you know, I'm not quite sure of the landscape around Durham, but, you know, to get to my nearest town, I have to drive 20 miles. And they were saying that, he drove 30 miles all the way to this castle or whatever to test his eyesight. Well, that's quite believable. If you were just to drive to a town and back again, it probably was 30 miles for him to get to this town. It all seemed perfectly sensible to me, but of course not to the mainstream media. And there was a hashtag scum media that was trending. I believe it was second. And a lot of people were showing their support and writing into the politicians and saying, look, we support Dominic Cummings. But the press weren't talking about that. But they did get their comeuppance on Newsnight, which I think was on the Tuesday night. They were still going on about it on the Tuesday night. And Newsnight began with a rant from Emily Maitlis that was made out to actually be the news, but it wasn't. It was opinion. And I've got a little quote about it here. The BBC has been swamped with tens of thousands of complaints from the public after Newsnight's Emily Maitlis let her left-wing bias show when she declared as fact that the Prime Minister's senior aide Dominic Cummings broke the rules, and Boris Johnson's blind loyalty to Mr. Cummings allegedly led to fury, contempt and anguish from the public in her introduction to the news show. He didn't break the rules. There are no charges against him. The government have said he didn't break the rules. So this is just purely her opinion, and it's being put across as if it's fact on the Newsnight. A source in the BBC told The Guardian that they had been swamped with tens of thousands of complaints after the Maitlis affair. News and politics website Guido Fawkes also claimed that there had been 18,158 complaints in the first 24 hours after Tuesday's Newsnight programme. And it's still going up. So that shows you the strength of feeling that there was behind this, against this attack on Dominic Cummings. And there was no reporting of it at all. And yet there were 18,000 complaints just within 24 hours about this. And Emily Maitlis hasn't been sacked. She should have been. They're supposed to be unbiased. They're supposed to just report the news without fear or favour. And yet it's just so obvious that they are partisan in this. I mean, when I report the news, I am reporting my opinion on the news, and it's quite clear that, that's what we're doing, news and opinion. But this is supposed to be the news. It's called Newsnight. And she still hasn't been sacked, of course. I think
Emily Maitlis has been criticised in the past for showing bias as well. And one of the things that I would say is that I've seen a number of interviews where she's interviewed other people where her body language exudes like naked hatred of the person that she's actually interviewing, which you don't seem to see with other people. And I think that it would be in her interests, if she wants to further her career, for her to look back over some of the recordings of interviews she's done just recently, and have somebody who's a body language coach her in how to appear less hateful when you're actually interviewing somebody. There was an interview where she was interviewing the Foreign Secretary of Hungary, and she was interviewing him over Hungary's attitude to the migration crisis that Europe is facing, and her body language, as I say, just exuded hatred. She may not have intended it to exude hatred to quite that degree, and I would hope that she wouldn't have wanted it to do that. And so she needs to look at that and perhaps take some coaching from a body coach who can help her to overcome that.
You know, she should have stepped down. She was one of the people saying that Dominic Cummings should have stepped down when he hadn't broken the rules, and she quite clearly did break the rules here. She's not supposed to just put across her own opinion here, but the BBC appear to have supported her. She's still in her job, and yes, there's a long list of occasions where she has done this. You know, too many to actually go into. There's just so many of them. The woman is so arrogant. She just epitomizes everything that's wrong with the BBC. There was also another striking moment of hypocrisy that came up in all of this as well. I mentioned last week about Ian Blackford, this rotund, low testosterone Scottish MP who was right at the forefront calling for Dominic Cummings to be sacked for this, and getting petitions together and calling for a parliamentary investigation into it. Well, it came out that a week or so into the coronavirus lockdown, Ian Blackford was in Westminster, where he was supposed to be, where the other MPs were still turning up for socially distanced parliament sessions. And Ian Blackford decided to drive all the way back to the Isle of Skye, about 600 miles from London, in order to self-isolate when he didn't even have any coronavirus symptoms. He didn't have a vulnerable child that he was concerned about. He just wanted to, he just thought that he would be better off driving back to his home in the Isle of Skye. Just absolutely incredible, that the barefaced hypocrisy of this man calling for Dominic Cummings to step down because he did the sensible thing within the rules, and Ian Blackford just thinks that he's above all the rules. He can just drive all the way back to Scotland, but through the roadblocks as well, no less. I mean, that was just incredible when I saw that. Did you hear about that? Because this hasn't been publicised that much, Max.
I have to say, no, I haven't seen that, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, as I say, the hatred towards Dominic Cummings comes from, first of all, a lack of acceptance that different people have different levels of importance within our society, and the desire on the part of everybody who's part of the left-wing liberal media establishment to regard themselves as being superior to everybody else. So on the one hand, they don't want anybody to appear to be more important than them, but they want to always be regarded as more important than everybody else. And when they see somebody that is politically at polls with them, then they and who is getting special treatment, well, they just zero in on that person with all of their vitriol in order to try and bring that person down.
Ian Blackford, I mean, it doesn't matter what the government does, Ian Blackford will always want to do the opposite. He will always want to prevaricate. He will always want to stop Brexit, or he'll always want to have a referendum in Scotland. And he just sets himself up at odds with everything the government does. I think he's the official Scottish National Party representative in Westminster, and he really is not a good representative of the Scottish people, I don't think. He's very irritating. I really, really dislike the man. But we've got some other news that we can get into here as well, which isn't to do with coronavirus. We were told last year that Boris Johnson has made this big pledge to increase the size of the police force, and now we are hearing about some of these people that the police force have decided to recruit. Thames Valley Police want to hire 183 diverse officers, so no white men need apply, apparently. Police are hoping to recruit officers from a range of backgrounds to be more representative of the area. Thames Valley Police started recruiting for 183 new frontline officers yesterday as part of the first wave in the government's pledge to hire 20,000 across the UK. Now, the Chief Constable of the Force, John Campbell, has said that diverse officers will help effectiveness of policing in the area. And I'll just stop there. So we've got two things here. They're saying that they need to employ black police officers because it's more representative of the area, which is basically admitting that the area is being taken over by non-whites. There are less and less white people there now, that they need to fill the police force and fill the authorities up with non-whites. So that is an admittance that white genocide is going on here. And when they're saying that will help the effectiveness of policing in the area, what are they implying by that? Well, they're implying that white police officers are not effective. Somehow diversity improves policing. I don't see how diversity can improve policing. We're told that blacks have unique problems with joining the police. And what are those unique problems? Well, a lot of them have got criminal records. So they said, well, black and minority ethnics, if they have criminal records, if it's not a violent crime, then they can still join the police. And there's an image that's going to go with this article, and it shows you a black policeman with a spliff in his mouth. And, you know, some people might say, well, that's offensive. But that is effectively what's going on. If you're going to allow black and minority ethnics to join the police when they've got small criminal records, that is exactly the sort of criminal record that they are going to have, is for soft drugs. They're also saying here about they're more representative of the area. Well, if you've got an area that's full of gangs and troublemakers, then that's exactly the sort of people we're going to have in the police now. Max, do you want to comment on this more representative policing idea?
Well, this is the same trend that we saw some years back when David Cameron decided he wanted to change the faces of the Conservative Party. I think his slogan was he wanted to change the face of the Conservative Party by changing the faces of the Conservative Party. And he wanted to have the sort of all female lists and all ethnic minority lists with regard to recruitment of candidates for the Conservative Party in future elections. And it was portrayed that this was a great step forward. And the point is that there is a contradiction in the argument that they use. I mean, first of all, they state that all people are equal, and so therefore it shouldn't actually make any difference whether the person representing your community in Parliament is black or white. And then they insist that they have to have more black and female representatives in order to improve democracy. Well, those two statements are self-contradictory. You know, if it doesn't actually matter to the vast majority of white British people that they have a black representative in Parliament, then why should it matter to black people in this country that they have a white representative representing them in Parliament? It shouldn't make any difference. If it does make a difference, then it makes a difference both ways. And it's but yes, I mean, as far as your analysis goes, I would agree with the points that you've made. It's it is indicative of the shift of power in this country away from the indigenous white population and towards immigrant groups. And it's very sad to see, and it's very sad that there are so many Indigenous white British people, particularly those that are in Parliament and that are in mainstream politics, that support this sort of thing, because it inevitably will be to their detriment as well as ours.
Well, it means a lowering of standards as well, doesn't it? I mean, instead of going for the people that have the best qualifications, that are the most fit for the job, they're not going for that. What they're saying is, well, we only want black, minority ethnics and women. We don't want to employ any white people. And it's effectively just saying, well, no white males need apply for this job. And who was it that came up with the idea of policing in the first place? Well, it was white males. I mean, I've seen some instances where they've had female police officers on the job, and the prisoners have just run rings around them. They haven't been able to arrest the person they're trying to arrest, and they fought back. And there was an instance where a female police officer was thrown into the road, and a bus wheel just missed her head. I've seen black people resisting arrest, and the female police officers try to whack them over the head with a truncheon, and it's just been pathetic. She hasn't even been able to wield the truncheon correctly, and the black criminals run away, and all the other people there have been cheering and laughing. They haven't been helping the police. This is another problem that we face now. The general public don't want to help the police. They're now cheering on the criminals that the police are trying to arrest, where we have such a high proportion of criminals in these multicultural communities. But apparently that's the sort of people that we now want in the police force, according to this Chief Constable John Campbell. He said the officer uplift offers a huge opportunity for Thames Valley Police to become more representative of the communities that we serve. A diverse workforce is an important part of the operational effectiveness for TVP and is essential in maintaining public trust with all of our communities. Well, wouldn't you say that an effective police force, a successful police force, a qualified police force is best? No. It's just if you've got black, yellow, female, homosexual, transsexuals, that's what we need. They're going to be the best at policing. He said the force had already worked on getting more women into frontline roles. Frontline roles, not, roles where they're going to be safe, where they don't actually have to use physical force. But no, they're going to push women into more frontline roles. But now the team need to work on hiring people from ethnic minorities who might be faced with barriers when signing up. And as I mentioned earlier, these barriers that they face when signing up is usually a criminal record. PC Yasser Zubair said his family had reservations when he decided to become a police officer. He said, but an officer visited us at home to talk openly about it. They looked like me, spoke the same languages we spoke, knew our culture, and they were able to reassure my family that I would fit in. That engagement allowed them to feel confident in my choice, and I haven't looked back since. So they spoke a foreign language to him. I mean, what languages are the British laws written in? They're written in one language. They're written in English. How can you say that we need police that speak different languages? What's going on here?
One of the things that shows the fallacy in all of this is the rioting that's currently taking place in Minneapolis over the death in police restraint of this black man whose name escapes me momentarily. But the reason why this is shown to be false is that the chief of police for Minneapolis, I believe, is black. The officer who was accused of kneeling on the neck of the black man who died was himself married to an Asian woman. And two of the four police officers that were involved in the arrest of the black man that died were non-white. And so, therefore, what you've got is a mixed-race police force apparently performing very, very much under par and performing in a way which betrays the fact that a mixed-race police force will police better than a homogenous police force such as would have existed in Minneapolis in times gone by. And so by introducing the same kind of quotas when you are recruiting police officers in this country will produce the same kind of results. It will produce police forces across the country who will be less effective, who will be divided by virtue of the racial divisions that will exist within the ranks of the police force, and who will be regarded as no fairer and no better than the homogenous police forces that we would have had in the past. You know, we will, as the population in this country changes through mass non-white immigration, then we can expect to see the same kind of social trends manifesting themselves in this country as exist in America. And we need to think again. Again, this is another argument for looking at the quality of people involved rather than going for equality all the time. You know, having a police force that appears to mirror the, and have the same racial proportions as the society that it serves doesn't necessarily mean you've got a better police force.
Well, I think if you look at the areas with the highest number of blacks in the police force, they're also the areas with the highest amount of crime. If you look at places like Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, places that have a very large black population and a large portion of the police force are black, they have the highest crime rates in the whole of America. And more needs to be made of the fact that it was a multicultural police force that carried out this killing. I think his name was Floyd George. And again, I mean, Britain is not going to be able to avoid those sort of things happening by having non-whites in the police. I mean, maybe the drive behind it is to say, well, at least then we can't get accused of racism when somebody black resists arrest and they end up getting killed. Thankfully, over here in Britain, they don't have, our police officers don't have guns, so there is less instances of it. But the problem in America is that black people very often resist arrest. And if you're living in a country where guns are available, then you can't take that chance. You can't take that risk. And you have to restrain the person that you are trying to arrest. And in a lot of these cases, or in some of these cases, the black person that's trying to resist ends up dying. But this instance here that's been going on in America, it's not even part of American police training to put your knee on somebody's neck. That's Israeli police training. I just hope we don't see similar race riots happening over here, and they're still going on over there in America at the time of this broadcast. But we seem to have left the British Isles in our conversation here, Max. Shall we get into our Greatest Britain series for the week? Do you think?
I think we can do. I think though that although we've drifted to an issue that exists in America, we were just effectively pointing out the parallel between the police recruitment in this country and the problems that have occurred in the USA as a result of them having those same police recruitment policies in the past.
Yeah, whatever happens over there in America, it ends up happening here in Britain, regardless of the mistakes that are made. We end up making the same mistakes. Well, let's start with a brief recap of what we did last week. We talked about Ranulph Fiennes and the books that he'd written, the fact that he was a fiction author, as well as writing up his exploits and his expeditions. We talked about, we sort of tried to make a guess at what his political views were. We said that he may have unofficially supported UKIP. He certainly hasn't officially supported them. He was clearly a traditionalist because he destroyed that Hollywood dam that was put in the village. We talked about some of his media appearances where he was an advisor for a lot of programs dealing with survival. We talked about his marriage and how his first wife, she died sadly due to cancer, which may have affected his choice in who he was going to do his charity work for, because it was for Marie Curie. We talked about some of the injuries which he's had, the heart attacks, the frostbite, cutting his own fingers off. We talked about many, many, many awards that he's actually been given, a long string of awards. That's about where we got to last week. And we're going to go into a little bit more detail about some of the expeditions that he went into now. But do you want to add anything to that recap from last week, Max?
Well, only really that a lot of the expeditions and a lot of the awards have been won during a period that's in his life where Ranulph Fiennes has been rather older than most people would imagine an explorer and an adventurer to be. And I think that this, as an individual, he serves as an inspiration to other people who are perhaps have entered middle age and who are perhaps tempted to think that the best of their lives might be behind them, because as Ranulph Fiennes has shown, that you can still do good things and do some of your best work in later in life.
He's a very good example for middle-aged people to follow, I think. Well, the first of these expeditions I picked here was from 2007, when he was 63 years of age, and he climbed the north face of the Eiger. It was a particularly hard, sheer cliff face that he climbed up. Ranulph Fiennes succeeded in climbing the notorious north face of the Eiger in the Bernese Alps, Switzerland, along with Kenton Coole and Ian Parnell. The climb was made even harder for Ranulph due to the frostbite on his left hand. Without the ends of his fingers to get a grip, the sheer rock face was particularly difficult, and he often had to rely on his axes to climb. The challenge raised £1.8 million for Marie Curie and was possible thanks to generous funding by Paul Sykes. Now, that's incredible. That, I mean, when you're climbing, all of it is about just getting the little tips of your fingers into a little crevice, and that's what you hold yourself up with. And he was forced to just hammer his ads into the cliff face and then pull himself up. I mean, just to think of doing that without, I mean, it's effectively, not being able to use your left hand to climb, and yet he was still able to climb up one of the most difficult climbs in the world, the north face of the Eiger. Do you want to comment on this at all, Max?
Well, just to say that it's, you know, an amazing accomplishment. And yeah, I agree with everything that you said. You know, if you people may think that just having the tips of your fingers missing wouldn't really affect your grip to any great extent. But if you imagine not being able to wrap your fingers around, even just, you know, if you're using an axe to climb with, not being able to wrap your fingers quite as far around the handle of the axe as you would do if you'd got all of your fingers there, you know, that is a significant handicap, and just makes the feat even more remarkable.
I mean, that is one sport, rock climbing, that you need to have your fingertips there for. I mean, he really did pick one of the worst things he possibly could have done with regards to his injury there, trying to climb up the north face of the Eiger. In 2014, at the age of 70, he attempted what was called the coldest journey. Ranulph and his team attempted to cross the Antarctic Plateau in the polar winter. It was one of the hardest expeditions ever attempted because of the weather conditions. Temperatures would drop to minus 90 degrees centigrade and it would be almost permanently dark. Unfortunately, Ranulph had to turn back after a skiing accident. Trying to fix his ski binding, he was forced to remove his gloves in temperatures around minus 30 degrees centigrade, and while the gloves were off only for a short amount of time, the temperature gave one of his hands severe frostbite. After a medical checkup when he returned home, diabetes may have been a contributing factor. So not only has he had these heart attacks, not only has he had these kidney stones, he lost his fingers due to the frostbite, he's also got diabetes. Now, I've been in temperatures of minus 40 degrees with the wind chill. I think it was probably about minus 15 degrees without that. And that was really, really cold. I mean, the cold goes right through to your bone. To say that, I mean, he was going through the Antarctic Plateau in temperatures of minus 90 degrees and almost permanently dark. I mean, you can imagine that just the sunlight would be such a blessing, just to see the sun in a situation like that where you were so cold. Just the sight of it, I think, would probably warm you up. What do you make of this one that he did at age 70, Max?
Well, yeah, I don't think we can reiterate enough just what an inspiration Ranulph Fiennes is. You know, one of the stories that I often tell is where I read Jack London's Mutiny on the Elsinore, which describes the first mate, who's like one of the main characters of the book, but he's described there by Jack London as being a man of 70 years of age who still has retained the strength of his youth. isn't quite as mobile as perhaps he would have been, but he still clambers around in the rigging and still gives the sailors, when they're being lazy, a bit of a kick up the backside and a slap round the head in order to keep them in line and to keep them working hard. And I've often pointed out to people that if ever they are approaching their, or, you know, entering their sort of sixth decade of life, and they, or their seventh decade of life, and they're starting to feel that age is getting the better of them, that they should read Jack London's book. But I would also suggest to them that they read Sir Ranulph Fiennes' biography as well, as an inspiration to make them realize that if they're determined enough, and that they are single-minded enough and plan ahead, etc., then they can still achieve great things even at an advanced age.
Yes, and he did that with diabetes as well. So you say that people that have got, you know, that have had illnesses, that shouldn't really be holding people back either. I should imagine that he has to exercise every day and keeps up with a lot of exercise when he's getting ready for these expeditions. In 2015, he did the Marathon des Sables, or des Sables, and that was at age 71. Ranulph completed the toughest foot race on Earth in aid of Marie Curie. The race itself is 156 miles long, 251 kilometres. Takes place in the Saharan Desert and lasted 6 days. Temperatures reach 50 degrees centigrade in the desert, and Ranulph had to carry all his personal equipment. The toughest part of the challenge was the double marathon day, when he had to run two marathons back to back in the searing heat. By completing the challenge, he became the oldest Briton ever to do so. And that's incredible to think that he's having to carry all his camping equipment with him, and he's having to stay out overnight, get up again the next day and run another marathon day after day after day in this heat, two marathons within one day at the age of 71. It's just, you know, incredible what the human body can do if you keep yourself fit and healthy, and you're continually pushing the boundaries. You know, you read about these great feats of our ancestors, and Ranulph Fiennes is showing that it's still possible to do these things today. I think we talked a little bit about this marathon in the first episode, Max.
Yeah, it's it is a series of marathons rather than just a single race. I think it's six marathons on the trot, a marathon each day, or presumably with one day where you do a double marathon. But it's running a marathon in the absolute searing heat of the desert rather than in the freezing cold of the Arctic or the Antarctic, which is perhaps what Ranulph Fiennes would have been more used to. But I know of people who have taken part in these kind of super marathons. I used to know a chap who used to do these kind of marathons over the Rocky Mountains in the United States, and I was absolutely sort of awestruck listening to his accounts of what he had achieved. But he was, you know, a young guy in his sort of late 20s at that point in time, to do something which is comparable, but with heat rather than cold being one of the main things that fatigue you, and to do it at Ranulph Fiennes' age is just absolutely amazing. And each one of these challenges that we hear about just really adds to our respect for him as an explorer and an adventurer.
And the money that he raises for it, isn't it? That's a big part of it, yeah, as well.
And an athlete, I should have added on that list of things as well, because as we've just established, you've got to be a considerable athlete to do these sort of things.
When we talked about Shackleton, we were talking about how he had to raise all this money to go out to the Antarctic in order to be the first to do these things and do the scientific work. And also we've talked about the large amount of money that needed to be raised in order to do things like go out and discover Australia and things like that. But what we've got here is he's got to raise the money to go on the trip, but then he's also raising money for charity as well. So he's actually making a lot of money for these charities. He's not just spending the money on being the first person to do this or breaking this world record. And the actual amount of planning and preparation that goes into these things is just incredible. I've got one more expedition here, which I think was one of his first expeditions, the Transglobal Expedition. Preparation took almost an entire decade, beginning in 1972 and not actually leaving England until 1979. The trekking team, led by Fiennes and including fellow Britons Charles Burton and Oliver Shepherd, had a support crew of some 36 people, including Ginny, his wife. So they've got a dozen people for each man on the trip. I mean, that is a big support crew. A lot of people are involved in making it possible so that he can do these things. During the 84,000-kilometre, 52,000-mile expedition, the explorers survived a polar bear attack, the loss of crucial supplies, and 3 months of being marooned on a drifting ice floe. So he must have got some idea of what it was like for Shackleton being marooned on this ice floe. And I tried to find information about the polar bear attack, but I was unable to. The Telegraph had something about it, but you had to sign up and pay some money to actually find out about it. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to get any details on that, because that sounds pretty interesting as well. Surviving a polar bear attack. I don't know if they had rifles with them. They must have had something to protect themselves against an attack like that. Have you heard about that one before, Max?
No, that's news to me, actually. I didn't realize that he had been confronted with a polar bear on one of these expeditions. But again, it sort of just adds to the the legend, really, doesn't it, of a man who doesn't let anything stand in his way. I fairly recently watched the film The Revenant again, and I can sort of clearly imagine what a polar bear attack must be like. And yeah, it's not the sort of thing that most people would want to entertain.
I should imagine he probably writes about that in his books, if anyone reads his autobiography. Well, they departed from Greenwich and attempted to stay as close as possible to the Greenwich Meridian as they journeyed southwards over land and water until they reached the coast of Antarctica in January 1980. So that's about a year it's taken them to get to there. And they basically did this without any motorized transport. It was, without flying. It was all over land and all over sea, basically. They did use motorized transport. They just didn't use flight. They remained there until October, when Fiennes, Burton and Shepherd departed on snowmobiles for the South Pole, which they reached on December the 15th. Setting out again after a short time at the American base there, they arrived at the Scott Base on the west coast of Antarctica in mid-January 1981, having made the continental traverse in a record-setting 67 days. So they broke the record for making it across the continent there. There they were met by their support ship, and over the next several months they voyaged northwards through the Pacific Ocean to western Alaska. They then headed east and north in an open boat through the Northwest Passage to Canada, before proceeding on foot in September to the settlement of Alert on the Ellesmere Islands' northern shore. And again, being in an open boat, that must have reminded him of being how Shackleton was in the lifeboats. They were open boats that they had. After wintering there for 5 months, the pair set out for the North Pole in mid-February 1982, arriving on April the 11th after an arduous trek by snowmobile and sledge. The journey home was no less challenging, hampered by difficult ice conditions and stretches of open water. After the two spent more than 3 months on a drifting ice floe, the Benjamin Bowring was able to retrieve them and sail home to Britain. The expedition arrived back in Greenwich in August, some 3 years after they had first departed and after having travelled some 52,000 miles. So I think it was eight years in preparation and 3 years to do the trip, just following the Greenwich Meridian line right the way around the world. And he was asked what it is that keeps him going in these instances. And he said, "There'll be a voice in my head saying I'll have a heart attack, or I'll get hypothermia, or I've got a family and it's stupid to carry on." Well, that sort of wimpish voice tries to appear logical, finding reasons for stopping, and you just have to fight it. I've had it so many times. So it's just single-mindedness, gritty determination, single-mindedness, strength of will and determination to succeed in the task that he has set himself. I would also probably add that also all the work that he puts into it and the preparation. And he obviously makes sure that he's done enough exercise that he's able to handle these sorts of challenges. But then also you've got to have this positive mindset at the same time. It's got to be a combination of both, being extremely physically fit and also having this strength of will. But I do believe while he was on this expedition, there was some kind of a tradition that he picked up on that gave rise to him making his own rum or something. Max, do you want to?
Well, this is what's referred to as the 1730 Club, and it's not really the same sort of thing as the 1830 Club that some people might be familiar with. I mean, the 1730 Club was something that was suggested by one of the expedition members, Oliver Shepherd at the time, and this was during the, I think it was the travel across the Northwest Passage, and Oliver Shepherd then suggested this idea, which is that no matter where they are in the world, and no matter what they're struggling to do, they should always take time at 5:30 in the evening to drink a glass of rum and to toast their successes, and this is something that Ranulf Fiennes's expedition teams adopted as a convention from that point onwards. And having returned to the UK, Ranulf Fiennes decided that he would set about distilling a rum in his own name, and he joined forces with a master distiller. Who was Dr. John Walters, I think the name is, and they have together produced a rum which is now being marketed as the Spirit of Adventure, Sir Ranulf Fiennes Great British Rum. And having found out that this was for sale, I decided that I would like to sample this, and so I've contacted the firm concerned and got myself a bottle of rum, and it's a very nice bottle of rum. It's a very it's a pale rum, and it's got a very what should I say, a very smooth and subtle taste to it. It tastes rather different to any other rum that I've tasted, and apparently the distilling process employed by John Walters is different from traditional distilling processes, and in particular with this rum, instead of distilling the rum and then putting the rum into perhaps sherry barrels or something of that sort, and then aging it in the sherry barrels so that the rum would absorb the color and some of the flavor from the sherry barrels, they charred some of the wood from three of Ranulf Fiennes' expeditions, and they put that wood actually in the still with the spirit that they were brewing. And the three types of wood are sequoia from the expedition that Sir Ranulf Fiennes conducted in British Columbia. They've got pine from the Norwegian expedition across the Jostelsbreen Glacier, and also date palm wood from Oman, where Sir Ranulf Fiennes discovered the lost city of Ubar. And you can certainly taste a kind of a woody flavour in the actual rum. And it's not a cheap rum. It's a premium price, and so it's £49 for a bottle, but it is an excellent rum. And what I can say here is that looking at some of their publicity blurb they've got here, the 1730 Club was born and still exists to this very day, from sailing the seven seas to the pirates of the Caribbean, Scaling great heights to plumbing the ocean's depths, rum has been associated with adventure. It's the spirit of daring do and no holds barred, of nothing is impossible. It's the spirit that takes your loftiest ambitions and puts the fire in your belly to achieve higher, further, greater than you ever thought possible. We have a unique flavor that can only come from the spirit coming into contact with the barrel. Instead of sitting in that barrel for 5 years, though, we put the barrel in the still. We're using exotic woods from some of Sir Ranulph Fiennes' most iconic expeditions, sequoia from Canada, Norwegian pine and date palm from Oman, to deliver multiple adventures in one bottle, distilling wood to extract the right flavors. May sound simple, but make no mistake, plenty can go wrong in the extraction. Only the skill of a true master distiller can pull off the feat successfully. The result is a golden spirit with a distinctly British character. And so it is a drink that I can heartily recommend, and obviously some of it will go to benefits Sir Dr. John Walters, and some of the profit from this, I would imagine, will go to benefits Sir Ranulph Fiennes. And so if he's the sort of character, sort of person that you admire and you'd like to feel that you have shared to some extent in his life and his successes, then this is a sort of product that you might want to invest in.
I think the tradition was started, it says, December 30th, 1979, on board the MV Benjamin Bowring. So it must be right at the beginning of the trans-global expedition. They decided that they would have this tradition every day and toast their success and the support of the crew and the beloved ones. And apparently every day they do that, raise a toast high into the air to the expedition, to friends and to family back home. So that must have really helped out, to have that little bit of the day that they look forward to, where they raise their spirits and thought of their family back home and just gave themselves a little reward at 5:30 every day. It's important to give yourself a little reward every so often for your hard work, I think. And that's quite acceptable, that, just to have a tot of rum, I think. So you would definitely recommend that then, Max?
Yeah, and I think that one thing to think back on is that in days of old, sailors and soldiers, particularly during the sort of 17 and 1800s, when soldiers used to wear red coats and bearskin hats, and they would march shoulder to shoulder into a withering hail of the enemy's fire, etc. In those sort of days, they needed something to give them a bit of Dutch courage, and so before battles, soldiers were given a mug of rum, and before sea battles, sailors were given a mug of rum as well, so that they would be inclined to do the sort of feats of daring do that the previous quote that I read out sort of referred to. And and I think that you know, it's a tradition that's got a distinctly British kind of aspect to it. In that respect.
I didn't realise that. I always thought, you know, Jamaican rum, I thought it was something to do with Jamaica. You know, I've learned something new here, that it was a British tradition, this drinking of the rum. I believe he's at the moment still involved in these challenges. He's got a current challenge at the moment, has he, Max? The Global Reach Challenge?
That's right. So Sir Ranulph Fiennes has announced his next record-breaking challenge, in which he will be risking life and limb to raise vital funds for the charity Marie Curie again. The Intrepid Explorer is attempting to complete the Global Reach Challenge and become the first person to have crossed both polar ice caps and climbed the highest mountain on each continent. So he's covered both global ice caps, and he's climbed Mount Everest. He's climbed the Eiger, which isn't quite the highest mountain in Europe, but now he's going to complete another challenge where he crosses both the polar ice caps and then climbs those highest mountains on each continent. And so, again, that's another really challenging expedition for him. And for a man who's now in his 70s, it makes it an even more challenging thing for him to take on. And he has a Just Giving page which can be found on the internet, and he has already raised £316,000. That much money has been pledged to him in connection with his challenge. And so, again, if somebody admires Ranulph Fiennes and wants to contribute to towards his further success, then that again might be something that our listeners might wish to contribute to.
With the advances in modern technology as well, I mean, you would hope that he would be sort of recording a video diary from this as well. So it says that people can follow his progress over the coming months, as well as support his challenge at that Just Giving site. So I would hope that he had some kind of a blog, and he was just making a little recording of what he had done that day, so that people could follow that as well. And he's also doing a speaking tour, and I know you've already been to see him once, Max. Do you know any more about this speaking tour that he's going to be doing this year?
Well, the speaking tour has been interrupted somewhat by the coronavirus situation. The very next speaking occasion I can see on the calendar is booked for the 10th of October 2020 at the Lighthouse Theatre in Kettering. But there are other dates that have been booked, which are for Yeovil, Barnstable, Poole, Bristol, Blackpool, Dorking, Plymouth, and many, many other places as well. And the website to look for is www.ent24/UK/tour-dates/Sir-Ranulph-Fiennes. And if you look for that link, then that will give you the program of speaking dates that are there for the future. The fee to go and listen to him speak is approximately £30. With some of them, it's a little bit more than £30. With some, it's a little bit less than £30. Yes, I did hear him speak some years back, and he is an inspirational speaker as well. And I think when you actually meet the man and meet somebody who has accomplished all the things that he's accomplished, you can't help but be inspired by their story. And so I would say to anybody who likes this sort of thing, anybody who has ever had a yearning to be an explorer or to take part in an expedition or anything of that sort, or who's got an adventurous spirit and wants to have contact with somebody who's not just talk the talk but walk the walk, then going to one of these speaking occasions would be a great thing to do.
Yeah, £30 well spent, I would say. I think you can get tickets as well at sirranulphfiennes.co.uk. It might be a little bit easier to type in there than all the hyphens there. Well, that's, I think I'll probably see whether I can make a trip out to see him at some point in that tour. Hearing about his exploits has really got me interested in the man, and we've also got more Greatest Britons that we're going to get into over the next few weeks, but I won't let you listeners know just who just yet. But thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you, and of course we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.